This is Alan Kozin, the author of Got That Something, How the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand Changed Everything, and you're listening to Fab Four Free For All, brackets, the brackets.
Welcome to another edition of the Fab Four Free For All. I'm your moderator for today, Rob Leonard, and joining me, of course, are my co-hosts, Tony Triguardo.
Hi, folks.
And Mitch Axelrod.
Hey, folks.
And today we have an author. His name is Jay Bergen. He is the author of Lennon, the Mobster, and the Lawyer, published by DeVault Books, or DeVault Graves Books. And it is about John Lennon's lawsuit against Morris Levy. And Jay was John Lennon's lawyer. And I have to say, Jay, I love the book. A lot of thing I learned about John Lennon in 1975 and the lawsuit that we really didn't know before. Welcome to our show, Jay. How are you?
Thank you very much, Rob. And thank you, Mitch and Tony, for inviting me and arranging this. I'm delighted to be here.
We're glad to have you.
Glad to have you. Let's start off. How did you get involved with this lawsuit? Because, you know, it seems almost random, but it's really not.
Well, my partner, my senior partner, David Dalgenes, had been hired by John to represent him in connection with the dissolution of the Beatles after John and Ringo and George left Alan Klein. And David was a real estate and corporate lawyer, and I was a trial lawyer. And I had been with the firm about, I guess, about 2.5 years at that point. And I had handled the Terry Knight Grand Funk Railroad litigation where I was representing Terry Knight. And I had heard these rumors around the office that there was some kind of a bootleg album that was going to be released, a John Lennon album. And I went to David and I said, you know, look, if there's going to be a litigation, I want to be involved. So on February 3rd, 1975, he asked me to go to a meeting at Capitol Records to learn more from the Capitol lawyers about this possible bootleg album by someone named Morris Levy, who I didn't know anything about. And so I went to the meeting with three Capitol lawyers, one of them from Los Angeles, the headquarters. And about halfway through the meeting, as they were explaining what information they had at that date, the conference room door opened and in walked John Lennon. To say that I was stunned would be a gross understatement, because I had no idea he was going to be there. I don't know whether the Capitol lawyers did, but we introduced ourselves. We started asking John some of the questions about how we got to that point. And, you know, pretty soon I got over being stunned, and he was the client.
Were you a Beatle fan?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I had seen them at Forest Hills on August 28th, 1964.
Wow.
Yes.
Cool.
So, hey, by the way, Jay, I have a picture for you that I own the copyrights to of Paul from August 28, 64 at Forest Hills. I'll send you a copy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
I'm sorry it's not John, but, you know. But that's kind of cool meeting someone you saw when you were, I'm not going to say how old you were in 64, but that had to be kind of exciting, right?
Well, I was 26 at the time.
Wow.
And
you still went?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had gotten married. Let's see. I got married in 63 after I got out of law school and clerked for a federal judge for a year. And my then wife, Betty, and I got two tickets and off we went.
Wow.
The sort of fun thing in the story, like a little bit of a subtext, Jay, is that there's that, you know, there are those little sort of side comments where you talk about the fact that you had sort of pushed down your rock and roll connection in a way, it sounded like. And that meeting John sort of, it seemed in the book like it kind of reawakened you back to, you know, to your music again in some ways.
Oh, it did, because you know, in 1967, I had moved to the Virgin Islands with my first wife. Then I caught her fooling around with somebody, and a divorce resulted, and I went back to New York. But I had met somebody in the Virgin Islands after the divorce, and we got married, and she did not like rock and roll music. And also, living in the Virgin Islands for a year and a half was like living on another planet, because there was very little radio and stuff like that. But once David Dalgenes handed me, a couple of days after that first meeting with John, he handed me Elton John's greatest hits, Ringo's album, Imagine, and one other John Lennon album. And I went home that night and played them, and I thought, oh boy, I'm home.
Best homework you ever got to do for a case, I'm sure.
Yes.
Hey, for those who don't know, Jay, can you just talk a little bit about, you know, what happened with how John Lennon ended up in litigation at first with Morris Levy, and which led to everything coming your way?
Well, in 1970, Morris filed one of his bogus copyright infringement cases, which he was well known for. And he claimed against the two Beatles publishing companies, claiming that Come Together infringed You Can't Catch Me, the Chuck Berry hit from 1956. Well, he only quoted in the complaint, which is on my website, by the way. It's only like 3 pages long. He claimed that the Come Together lyric, "Here Come Old Flat Top," when John was talking about a man who had once had a crew cut and now had hair down to his knees, infringed Chuck Berry's lyric, "Here Come a Flat Top," in the second verse of his song, where he was really describing a convertible that was passing him on the Jersey Turnpike one night. Wow. And finally, the case kind of just dragged on for a few years until October of 73, when John was out in Los Angeles and had just started recording his Golden Oldies album with Phil Spector producing, God help us all.
Well, he took a shot.
Case, John got a call in the studio that the case was about to come to trial in New York City, and he had to come back to New York. And John, as he testified, and as in the book, in my book, said, I'm working. I can't do that. You just go and settle the case. I can't do two things at the same time. And so the settlement was, and I think it was a way that Morris decided to get his hooks into John, instead of getting a payout of X thousand dollars. The agreement was that John, on his next album, which everybody anticipated was going to be the Oldies album, would record three of Morris Levy's songs owned by his publishing company. And one of them had to be You Can't Catch Me. Hmm. So that's what happened.
Sure.
Then Phil disappeared right before Christmas with the master tapes, all of the master tapes, 28 boxes of them. Capitol, John, whoever tried could not get in touch with him. John, meantime, you know, this is when, as you all know, was his lost weekend in Los Angeles, with a lot of carousing and drinking and drugging and, you know, getting kicked out of the Troubadour, from what I've read.
Also a lot of productivity.
Excuse me?
Also a lot of productivity.
Yes. Yeah. The problem was, Mitch, that there were all these musicians who showed up, and at one point they were like 28 musicians playing at the same time, and it was pretty frantic. And finally, sometime in the spring of 1974, John started, got bored, started writing some songs. And then in July, went into the studio with a band, went into the record plant in New York, and was going to record these songs, which became Walls and Bridges. But simultaneously with that, 28 boxes of master tapes arrived. And John, from they finally got, Capitol finally paid Phil $90,000 and got the tapes back. But the problem was that they were a mess, some of them. So John realized he had to put them aside. He had the band here in New York, and they went ahead and recorded Walls and Bridges. When Walls and Bridges came out, Morris Levy started jumping up and down, called Harold Sider, John's business advisor, and said, this is the next album, which he knew was not true, because Walls and Bridges was all John's original songs, none of which would fit. The other songs would, You Can't Catch Me wouldn't fit on it. So he demanded a meeting with John to have John explain it. And it was out of that meeting that John posed the possibility that he would want to sell the album on TV. Morris said, I have a company that does that. And how about that? And John and Sider, many times that night at that meeting, said, we have to get EMI's permission. Right. And everybody in the business, including Morris, knew that EMI had signed the Beatles individually and collectively since the early 60s. So that's what happened. And then the next thing that happened was in mid-November 74, after John had done the basic tracks with the same band from Walls and Bridges, Morris kept hounding him, when am I going to hear my songs? I want to hear my three songs. I want to hear my three songs. And one of the things I learned spending time with John was that he was very shy, and he did not like saying no to people. Mm-hmm. He found it very hard to say no because he thought he was being rude. He knew Morris was angry at him. So he finally ordered, he said to Morris, what do you want? And Morris said, well, I want to be able to play them in my office. So I want reel-to-reel tapes. John ordered, called the record plant, and they sent two reel-to-reel tapes of the album, 7.5 IPS, which is not the normal one, normal speed that you would record an album for release, which was 15 IPS then. And once he did that, Morris now had the entire album. It wasn't finished. It was unmixed, unfinished. And when John told Harold Sider what he had done, Harold said, I wish you hadn't done that. Mm-hmm.
Would this all have been a completely different story, Jay, if, well, two things. I mean, did, and I know you mentioned it in the book, but does, you know, did John get Morris's dander up by including that little snippet of Ya-Ya on Walls and Bridges? And
well, it wasn't
like that. What if, would it have all been totally different if John had just sent him copies of the three Levy songs that he covered and let it go with that? But, or was it just so tied up in this idea of Morris pushing him about, you know, I'm going to market the album.
Morris kept pushing him and pushing him and pushing him. And finally just, all right. He felt, and I think he testified about this and it's in the book. He said, you know, I don't like unfinished product, you know, floating around.
Of course.
But
of course.
I thought this was okay to give him because it really wasn't, it wasn't terrible. And that's why I don't think Morris was upset about the Ya-Ya. And by the way, Morris is one of the writers of Ya-Ya. Now, he no more wrote part of Ya-Ya than one of us did.
I did.
That's what he did a lot.
Of course, a lot of them did.
And steal the royalties.
Yeah,
of course. You know what, Jay? Sorry, Rob. We should say you mentioned the meeting. I think that was October 8th of 1974.
Yes.
I think we should tell people that is where Morris got the idea that there was an oral contract, which is the basis for the whole proceedings, right?
Well, I was about to get to that and basically say, because Morris kept saying, when are you going to call EMI? When are you going to go to London and get EMI's permission? And finally, after Capitol heard a cassette of the album, they of course wanted to release the album. And in late January, John had a meeting with the marketing people at the Sherry Netherland Hotel, where Capitol had a suite, and they went through the marketing. And then it was Sider's job to go up to Morris's office to tell him on January 30th that Capitol is going to release the album. And Morris turned around and pushed the tape recorder, the start button of a tape recorder, and all of a sudden Harold was listening to John singing "You Can't Catch Me." Mm-hmm. And Morris then said to him, and I think these are some key words, "I'm going to put it out. I've got a shot. I've got a shot." And I think what Morris meant by that was he thought he could then somehow maneuver Capitol, EMI, and John into some kind of an agreement where he'd still be able to put out the album. The thing that happened was that at the meeting on February 3rd, Capitol's lawyers were asking me about getting an injunction against Morris, because they now were hearing that he was buying advertising. And when I said to them, I think that's a mistake. It may be hard to get an injunction, but also in litigation, you don't want to be the party that fires the first shot. It's like a war, because you don't know what the reaction is going to be. And I turned to John and I said, how long will it take you to finish the album? He said, I can do it in 2 days. So he went in on the 4th and the 5th. He finished it. And one of the last things he did, because he's such a perfectionist, and I think that comes across in the testimony, he cut Angel Baby and Be My Baby.
Right. There's nothing wrong with them technically. They were just part of the whole Spectre thing, where everything was recorded slow. John Angel did his own producing, he did them more like the originals.
But Rob, Angel Baby's a mess. I mean, even when Jay's talking about it in the book, and you talk about some of that.
I don't mind Angel Baby as much. It got put on the Greatest Hits album released a year and a half ago.
The Ultimate,
John, Jay, my question is, can you give a little background on Morris Levy? I mean, he's the mobster in the book. Can you give some background on what type of mobster he was? We do know that the character Hesh in The Sopranos was almost directly based on Morris. So can you just give a little background for people who, would maybe be, might fear Morris Levy because of his connections?
Well, Morris was Jewish, so he could not be a made man in the mafia.
Okay. But
he had been involved with the mafia from very early on in his life. He opened Birdland in 1949, the famous jazz club on Times Square, with mob money. And he was tied into very, very tightly with the Genovese crime family. Some of the members, like Thomas Eboli, I believe that some of them were silent partners in either Roulette Records or some of the other minor record labels he had. And I think that was a way of, kind of siphoning money to the mob. And he was really locked in. He was also a very dangerous guy. And I tell the story in the book that right after he filed the first lawsuit in mid to late February, he assaulted a plainclothes New York City detective, damaged his eye so badly that it had to be taken out in an operation. About 3 months later in June, he and his bodyguard, Nate McCalla, were indicted by a grand jury for the attack on the policeman, the detective, and as I guess sometimes happens in New York particularly, there was a civil suit by the detective that was settled very quietly, and then the indictment disappeared. They were never charged. There was never a trial. The file just evaporated. So this is a bad guy.
Did you ever have any fear representing John? Hey, you might get out of your car and, you know, oh, look, someone's going to beat me up.
No, I thought of having my wife start the car in the morning.
Is this after you found out that he was cheating on you?
Actually, it never came up.
Okay.
John and I never discussed it.
Now that you've made Jay think about it, now he's going, what was I, out of my mind? Not
the fellows, the other thing is that this case at this point had such a high profile.
Sure.
With John Lennon, Capitol Records, EMI, he filed the first case in the New York Supreme Court in mid-February after Capitol released the album. He pulled the album, his album, Roots, he pulled the ads and told he had sold 1,270 copies at that point.
Wow.
And he filed the state court action, and I think he thought that John was going to, he'd get a reaction from John, like John didn't want to go to trial with the Come Together case. So when there was silence for another 2 or 2.5 weeks, his lawyers filed an antitrust case in federal court. And that was a fatal blunder, because New York Supreme Court cases move very, very slowly. In federal court, the day the case is filed, the complaint is filed, it is assigned to one judge for all purposes, meaning he's going to handle the whole thing. And that's just by the luck of the draw. They have a wheel where they assign cases. And this one was assigned to Judge Lloyd McMahon, who had been on the bench for 16 years. He was an experienced trial lawyer. He had been the United States attorney in the Southern District. And I knew Judge McMahon, and I knew his MO. And his MO was, I run the case, and we're going to have a fast, fast calendar.
You know, you mentioned that John was not engaged in the first, he said, I'm busy, I'm working, just settle the case. But in your proceedings all throughout, and it took a while, he was very, very engaged and an incredible witness. Why do you think he took such an interest in this particular one against Levy?
Well, first of all, I have reason to believe that the day I met him, or the afternoon, we had a meeting from 5 until 7 o'clock, I think, at Capitol's offices. And when John and I went down in the elevator together, and when we walked out of the building, he said, well, I'm going home. Good night. Mm-hmm. And I have really strong belief that that was the first night he went back to the Dakota after he and Yoko had been separated for a year and a half. And that's when he dropped out of the music business. Yoko became pregnant, and he decided that he was going to stand up to Morris. Because he wanted Morris out of his hair. Mitch, I think he realized that it was, we never discussed this, but I think he realized that the settlement of the Come Together case was a mistake, and he had to either stand his ground with Morris or he was going to have Morris around his neck forever.
Yeah.
And both John and Yoko said to me more than once, look, Jay, we just want to hold down the amount of money that John's going to owe Morris. And my response to that was, if I have anything to say, John's not going to owe him any money.
Wow.
But yeah. John was totally, to really answer your question more directly, he was totally committed.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever I needed his help, whenever I needed to prepare him for a deposition or something, he was there.
With due credit to both you and John, also, Jay, I mean, aside from all the other foul play that Levy was up to, you know, he had been putting out dozens and dozens of those oldies but goldies records and never paying a dime to the songwriters because so many of the songwriters and performers were in straits. They were in dire straits. They couldn't afford to go up against a Levy. So the good thing was when it came to John, he was finally picking on somebody who was not only his own size, but when it came to being able to get, you know, have someone like you be part of the team and to go after him, to put the type of work and the type of passion that you did into the case and that he was able to do, you know, you took down a Goliath who had messed up a lot of people, much less able to defend themselves than John. So that was a real kind of great thing, you know, that happened with that too.
Well, and he, I think John realized that. And I think Morris being, a grifter and a scam artist, again, he thought the second lawsuit would result in some kind of a deal. And when it didn't, he was really kind of trapped at that point.
Was he less of a businessman than he was a hood, basically, is what it came down to? Was he less of a businessman than he was a hood, really, when it came right down to it? Was he, you know, did he really not? Because it seemed that very early on in the case, it seemed as though you were very confident that a Morris Levy, or just Morris Levy, was going to trip himself up. And your instinct in that was real strong. And that is exactly what went down.
Well, I spent a lot of time with Maypang, with Harold Sider, with John, and a couple of other minor people nailing the facts. Because one of the things I had really gotten into early as a trial lawyer and a litigator was I thought the facts were all important. So you really had to get the facts down. And I knew, in fact, I said to John at one point that, Morris is going to have a lot of trouble. You're telling the truth. Morris is not telling the truth. There wasn't a deal. There wasn't any kind of an oral agreement.
Right.
There wasn't anything in writing. There weren't any negotiations of what your royalties would be. So Morris is going to have trouble. And the other thing that happened was that the lawyer who signed the federal complaint, the senior partner, William Shurtman, he turned over the whole case to a younger partner named Alan Kanzer. And Shurtman didn't show up until the trial.
That was ludicrous.
And he was not prepared, as you pretty much show in the book. The whole legal team was just not prepared because they really didn't have a case.
He wasn't prepared. And, you know, and you could tell the first day of the trial, Morris was not prepared because he kept volunteering testimony. And the judge just got thoroughly annoyed because he was wasting time. I kept objecting. The judge would direct him to answer the questions and not volunteer. So it was kind of a mess from the beginning.
There was an interesting variant, which I think really turned the whole proceedings around. An interesting interaction with Yoko. She had a premonition, and which led to, but the interaction with her then went on led to a mistrial, but it didn't lead to the mistrial.
It bore itself out. In other words,
Thank you, Tony. I was trying to come up with the good words. It bore itself out in the form of a mistrial, which I think was the best thing that could have happened to you. Can you explain that?
Yes. The second morning of the trial, Morris was still on the witness stand. The judge had really laced into him a couple of times on Monday. So there we are on Tuesday. John and Yoko would come down in the limo. They'd come up to the office. They walk into the office and sit down. And John said, "Yoko has something to tell you." And I looked at Yoko, and Yoko said, I consulted my Swami last night, and he said the trial's going to be interrupted today." And I thought to myself, a Swami, that's all I need to be dealing with a Swami.
Well, she reads tarot cards, you know.
I knew that she was into, you know, the stars and right. astrology and all of that. And I said to her, "What did he say?" And she repeated it. And I said, "You know, we've got a judge who's he's a racehorse. We're moving." And I looked at John twice, and he wouldn't look at me. Hmm. He just was looking across the room. Finally, we got in the car, and down we go. And sure enough, when I started cross-examining Morris again, you know, he was just volunteering and volunteering. All of a sudden, my colleague, Howard Roy, pulls on my jacket and points to Shurtman, and Shurtman is holding up so the jury can see it, the Two Virgins album, and turning it around so that he can see the front version of John and Yoko in the nude and the rear version. And I asked the judge if I could approach the bench. I grabbed it out of off the table where Shurtman had put it, handed it to the judge, and the judge turned around and started putting it into a waste paper basket, a round waste paper basket in back of him. And by then, Shurtman was next to me saying, "Please, please, Your Honor, don't throw that away. It's going to be one of my exhibits." And McMahon turned to him and said, "Not in my court." And that he then said to me, "Are you going to move for a mistrial?" So I said, "Can I consult with co-counsel?" We went back and talked about it. I said, "You've got to move for a mistrial. He's furious now." So we did. He discharged the jury. He apologized to the jury. And then he and Shurtman got into this ugly argument where Shurtman baited him to the point where the judge finally called him a liar. Wow. And then Shurtman said, "Then you should recuse yourself." So we had no judge, no jury.
And they thought this was a good thing, if I'm not mistaken, Jay.
Shurtman did. Mistrial was
going to work.
I think what he thought was going to happen, Tony, was that, okay, we've got no judge, no jury. We're going to have to start all over again in terms of get on another judge's calendar, and it'll be months and months and months. Well, that didn't happen.
You fixed that.
I went down to the chief judge with them. I dictated a memo to the chief judge, and we need another judge. And I'm convinced to this day, and I don't know this for a fact, that Judge Edelstein called Judge McMahon and said, "What happened?" And McMahon just laid Shurtman out and said, "You got to find another judge." And by the time we got back to the office, I mean, actually, when I went back up to the courtroom, John and Yoko were still there. And I said, "Here's what happened. I dictated the memo to the chief judge. You guys go home. I think we'll get a judge quickly." And Yoko said something like, oh, this shouldn't have happened. This is not good." And John said, "Yoko, Jay's in charge." And they went home. By 4 o'clock, we were down before Judge Grisey, and we started the trial the next day.
Yoko was saying it was a bad thing, but Yoko knew it was going to happen.
She knew. Jay, this is off the beaten path a little bit, but one of the things you got to do is hang out with John Lennon. And in many ways, you took him to different parts of New York City that he hadn't seen. You were almost, besides being his lawyer, you were a little bit of a tour guide too. Can you tell some of the places you went to that, you know, that John didn't know about he was now back to being a New Yorker, but there are a lot of places he hadn't been to yet. You took him to the Oyster Bar. You took him to a couple other places. You were a tour guide in many ways, besides a lawyer.
Well, I mean, as as we all know, as the four of us know, John really loved New York.
Yep.
He wanted to, that was going to be their home for good. So the first day we had the lunch break for the deposition, when they were taking his deposition, we were down near Grand Central. And I said to John, well, let's go over to Grand Central. There's a good seafood restaurant there. And he said, oh, I've never been to Grand Central. So we walked in off the Vanderbilt Avenue exit entrance, and he was just knocked out by the beauty of that room. We stood on that west balcony for a few minutes while he took it all in, and we went downstairs. We wandered around. I kind of followed him as he wandered around the floor of the main floor there, where the information booth was. Nobody, I don't think anybody recognized him. And if they did, they didn't go near him or approach him or anything. We down to the Oyster Bar. We had lunch. He asked me to get a table up against the wall and asked me to sit with my back to the wall so he'd be facing me. Two busboys came over and asked for an autograph, and he said, not while I'm eating. That was one of his rules. I'll give anybody an autograph as long as I'm not eating.
Right.
And the next day, we left and walked up Park Avenue talking about, that the deposition was over at the lunch break. And I asked him if he wanted to have lunch, and he said, no, Yoko's confined to bed because she's had a history of miscarriages, and I better go home. And we kept walking up Park Avenue, and finally he said, well, yeah, let's have lunch. So I took him into the Waldorf, and he said, I'd never been in the Waldorf. We walked in the main entrance through that spectacular lobby and then down to the Bull and Bear, and we had lunch there.
Trip.
And then during the trial, we had lunch every day for 20 days. They were at the trial 20 days at Sloppy Louie's, an old seafood restaurant down near the Fulton Fish Market.
That's a blast. Now Jay.
We should say that Sloppy Louie's has closed for those maybe wanting to go on a tour of this. Closed back in 1998. But
It did.
It was classic place, though.
I was going to say, Jay, you spent so much time going out to lunch, doing, and also working on the trial, which there was a lot of, I'll say, intellectual work to be done back and forth. You developed a real, kind of a well-rounded relationship with John, because you had that friendship between, and an intense thing going on, and you saw him as both, you saw the intellectual side, and I think on the stand, you saw something of the entertainer, John, too, in a way. So just looking at, stepping away from John the Beatle, how would you have described John the person? Did you say this is what this guy was like?
Well, since he had dropped out of the music business, he was really chilled out. I think he was very happy. He was awaiting the birth of what turned out to be Sean, who was born in October of 75, three months before the trial. He enjoyed not, as he said in that one song, he enjoyed not watching the, just watching the wheels go around.
Yeah.
He didn't want to be involved. I'm sure you remember the story about when he was just a person.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, aside from the great testimony he gave about how he made records. I wanted people to know that this was not John Lennon, the rock icon, who was, kind of parading around New York. He was the exact opposite. He was laid back. He was very pleasant. When people asked him for autographs, he was very polite. He was in a good place, and it was really, I'd read some stuff about him before, this was somebody who was completely different.
You mentioned, I have to bring this up again. First of all, that, people need to get the book because there's so much of the transcript of the trial. And John, as you mentioned, was an unbelievable witness. As good as you with your memory, which is unbelievable, John was too. And he really laid out everything. And I implore people to buy it just for that. But you mentioned Two Virgins. And we should say that when the Roots album came out, John said the cover was crummy, which is why they brought up Two Virgins. Well, for one of the reasons, to show the cover and you know, and people have to read it to find out more. But my favorite line was when John questioned the lawyers and said, "Where'd you get that? That's very rare." I mean,
where did you find that?
Yeah. That's really didn't rare. They ask him to autograph it?
That was
bizarre. Again,
you want to talk about fatal blunders?
Yeah.
Shurtman spent a couple of pages trying to make this argument that the Two Virgins album was in poor taste. And John told the story about how the head of EMI wouldn't let Capitol or EMI release the album, but he said he wouldn't tell me that to my, he didn't have the guts to tell me that to my face, but then he asked me to autograph it. Well, Shurtman, right there on the record in front of the judge, after talking about, you know, how the poor taste it was, asked John to autograph it after the trial. And John said, "Well, sure, I'll be glad to." Yeah. It'll be worth and that to me on the case. Underground.
Yeah, to mean the case even more. The really funny part about that, Jay, is that by the mid-70s, there were already bootlegs of Two Virgins floating around. So it would have been even funnier if, you know, unbeknownst to that it was a bootleg copy of Two Virgins, but you never know. Anyway, but you know, Jay, the one person who comes into the story in an odd way is someone who, you know, in Beatle world is always the villain. And yet in your story, in the situation that happened, Alan Klein shows up.
Yeah.
And actually kind of benefited the situation in a way from the way I kind of read everything that went on. So can you just touch a little bit on how Klein got into this story a little bit?
They called him. they had called him and taken Klein's deposition, but then they called him as a witness. And as you just commented, his testimony was damaging.
Yeah.
And it led the judge to asking Morris some questions on his own that increased the damage and really kind of blew a big hole in Morris's case.
Yeah.
You know, of course, Alan Klein, he never had any legal problems or anything like that. He never was accused of taking anyone's money for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other mystery. Yeah. Why John kind of fell in love briefly with Alan Klein. I mean,
that's
a mystery.
Jay, yeah. with having been part of the case with John and now so many years later and the different books that have come out, just out of curiosity, have you looked into, you know, all of the different books that have been out about all of the other Beatles lawsuits? Have you kind of ever looked into all, you know, the rest of the insanity that went on?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, and I all the time I spent with John, I never said to him, "Well, tell me, what was it like?"
Yeah,
meeting the Beatles, or I'd like to order your autograph.
Yeah,
I mean, the picture that Bob Gruen took at Sloppy Louie's of us having lunch. I'd never met Bob before, and I didn't know he was going to be there, and I also didn't know he was in the courtroom the day he smuggled the camera in.
Yeah.
I just want to reintroduce him. You know, we're talking with Jay Bergen. He is the author of Lennon, the Mobster, and the Lawyer, The Untold Story, published by, DeVault Classics. DeVault Books, I'm sorry. And we should say that that Bob Gruen does the foreword in the book. You just mentioned him. Because he did take technically an illegal picture in the courtroom. I'm not sure how it handled today, but he did take a picture of John testifying.
I asked Rob, I asked Bob if he would write the foreword, and right. said, yeah. I'd be honored to. Nobody's ever asked me to do that. He also licensed for a very reasonable fee the 8 photos,
right,
including the cover of the book. So Bob's been a great friend to me, and as we all know, he was very close to John and Yoko.
And he's a good guy, and Bob's the type of person who Bob likes to see the truth get out there.
Yes, Bob's
always been that way, especially when it comes to right. how closely he held his friendship with John.
I just want to get my question after what you just said. Why did it take like 40 years to get the book out? You know, it's your memory is sharper than anything, and then hours. And we're just curious. I'm just curious. Why did it take 40 years? You know, there were many opportunities along the way to do this book. Why did it take to this point? And thankfully, you're in great health. We're seeing you on Zoom right now, and. Yeah, you look like you're having, you know, you're looking good. So, and you're sounding good. So, you know, why did it take this long to get this book out?
I don't think it was a question of taking this long. I mean, I saved all the trial transcripts. I also had the entire appellate record, including all the exhibits. That meant I had about 10,000 pages of documents, plus Beatles and John Lennon albums that we used to show the care that the Beatles and John took in their album covers. And these, I carried these around for five or six banker's boxes, and they were just always with me. I never looked at them. I never opened them until 5 years ago in the spring. I don't know why, Rob, because they were always with me. And I think maybe it was just the connection with John.
Right,
but I had them stored in a storeroom in our garage, and I went out one day and I was thinking, well, maybe I should donate these all to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or something like that. And I sat down on one of the boxes and started reading John's testimony, and then I thought, there's a story here.
Oh yeah,
definitely. I've got to tell this story and tell this story about. Not only using the transcripts and the exhibits, but also about who this man was.
Yeah.
At that period of time in his life.
You had mentioned Yoko, and you also mentioned May and the Lost Weekend. So I want to just get back to one thing. You know, rock and roll, Walls and Bridges, there was so much done during the, quote, Lost Weekend when John was with May. And May ended up testifying. Was there any kind of awkwardness at all involved with Yoko and May at that time, especially since John was just getting back into the Dakota and then May had to testify?
Well, by the time May testified, it was really in January of 76 when we were doing the breach of contract part.
Right.
No, there wasn't anything awkward except the day she testified, and the court ended, the court day ended, and John came up to me as I was loading my briefcase and said, "Jay, you have to get Yoko. You have to get May into the elevator. She's wearing Yoko's coat." and I said, "What? What's the problem?" "Jay, she's wearing Yoko's coat, and we can't wind up in the same elevator with May." So I said, "Well, I don't understand." He said, "Just please." So I said, "Okay." So May was out in the lobby talking to my colleague Howard Roy, and we kept talking and talking, and I kind of eased her over towards the elevator. And finally, the elevator door opened, and she got in and left. Her testimony was over. Her testimony was great. And she was important because she was one of the people who was there that night at the Club Cavallero when Morris claimed this oral agreement was made. But anyhow, that was, you know, she got in the elevator, and John and Yoko left later on. But that was the only time that... really anything came up about May, and I had to use her as a witness because she was a key.
There was also, you also had a couple of other witnesses in rock and roll, you know, aside from Dave Marsh, which we'll get into in a minute, but you had a couple of John's musician friends come in and testify. I know you were a little apprehensive about having rock and rollers come in and trying to be on time and all that stuff. Can you mention a little bit about that?
Well, I wasn't apprehensive once I went out to California and met Klaus Voormann, Bobby Keys, Jim Keltner, Kenny Asher. And then on my way back, I caught up with Jesse Ed Davis, who was on the road with Rod Stewart and the Faces. And I interviewed Jesse at the hotel that they were staying in outside of Detroit. And he was very smart. Had a great sense of humor, and he was very quick. And I decided right then that I was going to use him. The other witness was Eddie Motto, who lived up in New Hampshire. And I didn't see Eddie until the day before he came down to testify. But I talked to him on the phone, and I just had a good feeling about both of them. And they were excellent witnesses, particularly Jesse. Jesse was very, very sharp. When Shurtman was cross-examining him and was talking about how when they rehearsed up at Morris's farm, weren't there lead sheets? In other words, that Morris had supplied lead sheets so that the band could rehearse, and that was kind of the deal. And Jesse, in a totally off-the-cuff remark, said, "Well, yeah, there were lead sheets lying around, but you don't need a lead sheet to play Tutti Frutti, you know." And that was completely right out of his mouth. I mean, that was unrehearsed, you know.
And again, another blow to Levy's case.
Yes, another blow to Levy. You know, and Eddie Motto testified. He said, "Well, we all knew the songs from when we were kids."
Right.
Right. And what about Dave Marsh? He was with Rolling Stone. He was an incredible witness for you too, right?
He was terrific. In fact, if you look on my website, you'll see under the court documents a letter that Dave Marsh wrote to me the day after I met him. When I decided I needed, when we got to the counterclaims, I needed an expert because the judge told us, as you three guys know, the judge was a musician, a harpsichordist in a classical music group, and knew nothing about the Beatles. Mm-hmm. But he made it clear to us, "I listen to a lot of music. So if you're going to want me to award damages, I have to understand this music." So we brought record plant equipment into the courtroom and played it. I'm losing my train of thought. What was I saying?
With Dave Marsh.
Oh, Dave Marsh. Yes. So I called Chet Flippo at Rolling Stone, who had written an article earlier in January. And I said, "Look, I need somebody to testify about the two albums and comparing the two albums." He said, Let me switch you over to Dave Marsh." I went right over. I talked to Dave. I said, "Can I come over and meet you?" "It's fine." So I came over. I brought him each one of the albums, the Roots and the Rock and Roll. And I said, "I'd like you to listen to these. And then we can discuss them. And you can tell me what you think of the Roots album as opposed to the Rock and Roll album and testify about that." He said, "Yeah, sounds interesting. I'd be glad to." The next afternoon, Mitch, I get this hand delivery of a two-page with a little bit on a third page, single-spaced letter from Dave comparing the two albums song by song. In other words, "Ain't That a Shame" on Roots and "Ain't That a Shame" on Rock and Roll. And that's on... That's on my website. And it was just a great letter, and he was a great witness.
Yeah. As I said earlier, there's so much more to this than we're giving right now, because we, first of all, we want everybody to obviously get the book, but I was so fascinated by John's testimony in general, the intellect of John Lennon, and everybody knows John is an intellectual, was an intellectual person, but the intellect that he displayed, and as you said, he never got angry when they were asking questions, because he could have gone off the rails. He was, again, based on the transcript, which people need to read, he was just such an incredible witness.
It struck me too much, and Jay, you know, but it struck me too much that John, like, other than the, like I say, the intellectual side, there was a little bit of that showman. There was a little bit of that. And especially because I think he knew the judge was hungry for information, and you kind of told John to play into that. Like, you know, sort of at numerous points, kind of saying, like, John, he wants to know, just like, you know, get this to him. And I think John turned on a little, like a little bit of the, you know, the showman, you know, to give the judge the full story.
Well, you're 100% correct, Tony, because he did. And he also, when he wanted to kind of stick the knife into Shurtman and Morris, you know, he did it very, very nicely, very politely. And as you mm-hmm. just said, he never lost his temper. And he showed also that he had a great sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the result?
I mean, that came out.
What was the result of everything? You know, without giving too much away, obviously, you know, Levy won a little bit, and then, you know, everybody else won a lot more.
Yes. Yes. And it was a tremendous defeat for Morris. And, you know, and while John was on there, was in court every day, Morris was not. Morris dropped out. And he realized the jig was up. And I believe he spent a lot of the time, you know, in Florida after the first part of the case was over.
I found it very interesting. The only time John ever really wanted to leave was when they were actually going to play the songs from Roots. And you told him, you cannot leave now.
The judge, we were all set to play Ain't That a Shame from each of the albums. And of course, Dave Marsh was on the stand, and the judge got a telephone call. So he left the bench for a couple of minutes, and I went back, and John was there, and I sat next to him, and he said, are you going to play the Roots, some of the Roots songs now? And I said, yeah, because the judge wants to hear them. He said, well, Jay, I can't stay here. I'm going to leave. Yeah. I said, leave? I said, you can't leave. The judge is going to notice that you're gone. You can't leave. He said, it's going to be terrible. I don't want to hear it, because he had never listened to it.
Right.
Right.
He had never listened to it. He did listen to the commercial when Jimmy Iovine called him and said the commercial's on that weekend of, I think, February 7th or 8th, 1975. But he said, I can't. It's just, it's too painful.
It was a 2-minute commercial, too. It goes on and on and on. So
yes,
it is on YouTube for those who might want to see it. Jay, is there any way that Levy, I mean, he had a bad case, but was there anything that Levy and his lawyers could have done maybe to do it differently? Because, you know, one of the things about your book, after like the first 25 pages, you know that John's going to win. And not just because we know the history, it's just that Levy has no real case. Is there anything he could have done to maybe change that, where maybe he
actually
would
have a contract, Rob?
Well, that's starting there. Well, yeah, contract's always good, you know.
Contracts are always good.
Contract good.
But is there anything, because it just, I mean, you get to the point where, you know, he's like you said, he's not in the courtroom. Obviously, he doesn't believe he's going to win then, and you know, it may come up with something better or different or something.
He could have bought all the copies of that Stephen Stills album, too, so Jay didn't find that either.
I think he could have made it more complicated and difficult. I mean, because one of the things that was difficult for us was dealing with the fact that John and Morris were spending time together.
Right.
that he would go to, he and May would go to the Club Cavallero. Then they went up to the farm. Again, an example of where Morris kept asking him to go and go and go. And John would say, well, you know, I'm this weekend I'm going out to Montauk to visit my friend Mick Jagger. No, no, we'll come the next weekend. But, and then they went to Florida. When Julian, John's son, came over for Christmas, Morris heard about that and invited John and May and Julian to come to Florida. I mean, John paid the expenses, but Morris found a place for him to stay. A friend of his gave him his condo, and then they went off to Disney World. And that was something we had to deal with. And in the both of the opinions that Judge Grisey wrote and then the Court of Appeals opinion, they mentioned that they were spending a lot of time together. Why?
And
the only explanation was that John at one point, when Shurtman tried to get him to say that he and Morris were close friends, John said, well, no. I thought he was a character.
But John did go up to Morris's farm to rehearse.
With the band.
With the band for the rock and roll album. So what became the rock and roll album? Yeah. Or the Roots album, however you want to look at it.
whichever. That's right.
Yes.
So two final question from me, Jay, a little bit of a two-parter. Number one, did you ever keep in touch with some of the principals? And second, do you own a copy of the Roots album?
I do.
You do?
I do. Because part of the final judgment was that Morris had to turn over all the unsold Roots albums. So I had four boxes of Roots albums plus the 8-track tapes.
Wow.
Wow.
Can we come visit?
Any extras around you? No.
I called Yoko after they came back from Japan in 77. And I said, I've got these boxes of albums and tapes that I want to bring up to you. And she said, what are you talking about? And I explained it to her. And I think she was surprised that I was going to give them to John. And, you know, I took them up there and I didn't see John, but I gave them to Yoko. And I don't know whatever happened to them. I did keep one for myself, one for Howard Roy, the judge's law clerk, asked me for a copy of each of the albums so they could give it to the judge on his 5th anniversary. And I know I sent one to Eddie Motto and Jesse Ed and Dave.
Wow. So what you're saying is that Yoko still has a bunch of boxes, right?
No, Yoko sold them to It's Only Rock and Roll on 8th Street, probably. Enough. I'm sorry, I'm kidding.
Speaking of being out of business, everyone, that's out of business too.
I know.
Wait, time out as I go and write a letter to Yoko. I'll be right back. I have an email going out tomorrow.
Well, Sean's been using them as frisbees.
Tony, I'm not going to comment on your suggestion.
He knows. Jay, has Yoko commented or anyone, Sean commented or even May commented about the book? Has there been any comment from them?
No.
No. Okay.
Silence.
So have you kept in touch?
Yoko is seriously ill.
Yeah, we've heard.
Yeah.
No.
So you haven't kept in touch with any of the principals?
Oh, I've stayed in touch with Jim Keltner, Eddie Motto. After the trial, I had occasion to go out a couple of times to Los Angeles, and I have to tell you this one funny story. When I interviewed Bobby Keys out there, you know, remember Bobby played with Buddy Knox and the Rhythm Orchids? They had a big hit, Party Doll.
Yeah.
And I think somewhere their paths crossed with Morris in the 50s, because when I interviewed Bobby Keys, he said to me, I do not want Morris Levy to hear my name. Do not mention Yikes. My name. And one day, Bobby suggested that the two of us go horseback riding up in the Hollywood Hills, above the sign, you know, the big Hollywood sign. And, you know, Bobby was from Texas. He was from West Texas. I was from Long Island, Valley Stream. I'd been on a horse maybe once or twice in my life. And so we had a nice ride, you know, through the hills up above. But when we turned to go home, back to the stable, my horse took off. And all I could think of was, because I was just hanging on, all I could think of was a headline that would say, you know, New York Park Avenue lawyer killed him in the Hollywood Hills, horse thrown by a horse.
Oh, God. Now, one thing I got to add, because you mentioned Bobby Keys, I interviewed Tommy James last year, and I said to him, after John Lennon won his case, did you ever think of suing Morris because, hey, he had lost and maybe, you know, that would continue? And he said, no. That's all he said was no. And it took, of course, till Morris died and Roulette Records got sold, and then they found money for Tommy, and he actually got some money. Yeah. But he wasn't going to – Tommy James is the most famous out of everyone who's dealt with Morris Levy and money.
And John.
I've read Tommy's book. I'd like to meet him sometime. But,
yeah.
You know, Rob, remember, sometime later on, and this is before Morris died, I believe, the two songwriters from who wrote Why Do Fools Fall in Love, the Frankie Lyman hit,
right,
they won a big judgment, I think, against Morris's record company, a couple of $1 million or $1 million.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
He had cheated them out of the publishing royalties.
That's what he did.
Amazing.
Sounds like a fun guy.
He sounds like a guy that never worked a legitimate day in his life.
But he knew how to break hands.
Look, I think I said this in the book, fellows. Morris was one of those people, if there was a right way and a wrong way to do something, you know, a crooked way, he would always choose the crooked way. Oh, yeah. He was a crook.
By the way, Jay, I know you have you know, manuscripts and stuff of the court case. Was there any audio or video recorded at that time?
No,
at all.
They didn't do that in those days. They had what they had was, Rob, you know, the stenotype machine.
Right.
And the court reporters would rotate through the courtroom. And so that by like 7:30 or 8 o'clock that night, you would get what was called daily copy. It was expensive, but you would get the transcript from the day, that day, so that you could use it the next day if you needed it.
Sure. Okay. Too bad there was no audio. I'd love to, you know, hear just the way John would explain things, because, you know, he had a way of talking, as we all know. So,
well, I was. By the way, the fellow that did the audible,
Scott McKinley,
the audible is excellent. He really did a terrific job. But I've always thought that, or I was hoping that people, when they were reading John's testimony, would be able to kind of
hear him.
Yes, and I agree. That's where I heard
his voice.
Oh, it you definitely can, you know, especially if you're a big Beatle fan. You could easily hear him explaining everything about mastering and mothers and all the good stuff he was talking about, which is just, again, reason enough. If there's nothing else in the book that was good, which the whole thing is, the transcripts are just a fascinating read.
Well, I think they're very, I appreciate you saying that, because that's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, but also to get those into the book, because they're very historical.
Yes. I mean,
John had done hundreds and hundreds of interviews, but he had never discussed the recording process.
Right.
Very little. You're right.
The way he said he and the Beatles learned the trade in an interview, it never came up.
The one last thing I want to say is, and I don't know if you ever thought about this after the fact, and I have to read it because it's very interesting. In one of the transcripts, they're talking about unreleased songs. And John says, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but John said, the Beatles may have two tracks that were never released. And one of them is from 62. And I have one. And there's the Spectre tape. So now I have three that they could release if I died, which I would hate to have released. And now we know that the Beatles did make Free as a Bird and Real Love. So they pretty much did take his unreleased stuff after he died and put it out. I found that.
But I always thought it wasn't those two. I always thought that one of them was How Do You Do It? Because at that point,
well, yeah,
I'm he not was given a copy of that.
I'm not 74. Saying those were the unreleased. I'm just saying in general, he didn't really want people releasing stuff that he wouldn't have released after he died. And the Beatles themselves ended up doing that.
Well, you know, I have no problem with
Rob,
that.
I think, Rob, you mentioned earlier about how Angel Baby and Be My Baby were, one of you did.
I did.
On our greatest hits.
It's on the John Lennon anthology.
I don't think John would have liked that.
Really?
I know he wouldn't have.
I agree. No. Okay.
Well, they remixed Angel Baby for the Give Me Some Truth two-disc greatest hits that came out, and they did change a lot around the mix, so he might like that mix. And Sean did it, so it wasn't like it was a stranger. So
he
had very strong feelings about that.
Right.
Yeah. I think the way Jay sums it up in the book, I think the only way John, and I'd have to go back and listen to it, is if Sean took some of the individual tracks and actually put them in tune with some of the other ones. Because there are instruments playing in different keys on that record. It's
ridiculous.
It was awful.
Yeah.
So,
but anyway.
So Jay, what's on your website? We're talking about some material that didn't make it to the book, but is now on the website. And what's the website URL?
The website is www.LennonTheMobsterAndTheLawyer.com, all together. And you will be able to, when you go on the website, you will also be able, that will take you to my Facebook page. And there's a lot of information that I've put on the social media and on the website too. But let me tell you one more thing. There are four chapters that my editor, Lorraine Ash, who is an expert on memoirs, and when we had to really cut the length of the book down, she talked me into taking four chapters out of the book because they really didn't flow with the rest of the story. And I'm going to be putting them out in the next the next couple of months. Four chapters
on the website.
On the website.
Okay, that's great. That's we'll print it. Will it match the book, or will if we print it out?
It'll be printed out. It'll look very much like the book.
Right. Okay, that's great. And how's the reception been? I know you're at the Chicago Fest, and I know you're going to be at the Fest in 2023 at both the Chicago and New York. Right. How's the crowd been reacting to this? Because there's so much here that wasn't known.
I tell you, the thing that struck me about the Fest in Chicago was I've never seen so many people happy to be together and experiencing the Beatles and, enjoying talking about it and, signing books and the people who I signed books for, almost every one of them wanted a photo of me with the book. It was just, I said to my wife, this is like a family.
Yes.
A family reunion where everybody still likes each other.
but you're right. I know we've been at the Fest both as people who've been on panels and also as just people who walk around. It is sort of a family once a year reunion, and it's only 3 days, and it's a fun time because we all love the Beatles. And that's what we talk about. We don't talk about politics or anything else like that, or the cousin that isn't talking to anyone, because you're talking about Beatles.
I'd rather be at the Fest than with my family.
Maybe this happens at every reunion, but there was kind of a little corner on the way into the main meeting rooms and the grand ballroom where guests, Beatles fans, brought their instruments.
Oh yeah.
Right. Oh yeah, yeah.
They would get together and play and dance and
all night.
It was amazing.
All day and all night.
Yeah.
Yes.
Rob's been part of it.
Yes. I've been there for like 5 hours in a row, It did. I leave at 4 in the morning,
Yes. So,
yeah, definitely. It's a fun time. It's nice that Beatle fans still have a place to go to not only meet people like you, but, you know, just to hang out and you know, you can talk, you can do shortcut talking when you're with Beatle fans about, you don't have to explain what the album Revolver is, you know, or, you know, Meet the Beatles was different than With the Beatles, but, you know, you don't have to explain everything because everyone knows. You know, that's part of it. So
hopefully you'll sell a couple
of thousand trivia experts.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's the other side. Yeah. There's a lot of people there who know what's right. Then there's some people who think they know what's right. And some of them are our friends. So
I'm not telling, at least
they were before name this
names,
book.
Are we?
No, we're not going to name names.
No, we're not. Maybe
but
privately.
If we need an attorney, we'll call you, Jeff.
I have to say, I'm not going to name names to a lawyer. Anyway, Rob.
And this has nothing to do with the Beatles, but you represented Terry Knight versus the Grand Funk Railroad. We're all Grand Funk Railroad fans here. Where's that book? That must be a great book.
There wasn't as much going on there, but
the Grand Funk had to change their name.
The case was ultimately settled very favorably to Terry, and I don't think John Eastman and the band realized it. But there was the funny story I told John one day we were walking along about John Eastman, and I'll leave that one for people to read.
Yeah, leave that as an exclusive, definitely. But the good thing is, we've talked a lot about the different points, but it's still, I'll tell you, it still doesn't take away from the book. So, no. You know, we spent, no. You know, such all this time chatting about all the different aspects, things that went on in the case and whatnot, but the book stands alone. People really need to go
and read
it.
And it's an easy read, too.
Great read, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great book. Here it is for those watching on Zoom. Lennon, the Mobster and the Lawyer, The Untold Story by Jay Bergen, forward by Bob Grun, published by DeVault Graves Books.
Yay.
And Jay, thanks for coming on.
Eight of Bob Grun's photos, including a classic one of John on the witness stand and the explaining something to Judge Grisak.
That was an illegal picture, but I love the uncle, the Sloppy Louis picture. That's a really nice picture.
That's a great
of all of you at the table.
Did you all notice the tie?
Oh, I was going to mention that the tie you asked John about real quick so we could wrap it up, but explain that.
I asked him about the tie, and I said, I'm sure there's a story that goes with the tie. And if you look at it in the book, it's a hand-painted tie that he bought on the Upper West Side. I think in a secondhand store or something. And it depicted a butterfly caught in a spider's web. And John said, I'm the butterfly and the spider is Morris. And I'm going to wear this tie every day of the trial.
Wow.
To signify. I couldn't figure out how to get him to explain that on the witness stand. I thought it was a little bit too much.
Yeah, mine and mine.
Well, Jay, we appreciate you coming on our show here. We love the book. Thank you very much. My name is Rob Leonard. I've been your moderator today. And joining me, of course, is Jay Bergen, the author of the book, Lennon, the Mobster, and the Lawyer. Mitch Axelrod.
Take care, folks.
And Tony Triguardo.
Bye, folks. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you. I appreciate very much the three of you. You asked great questions and you were very patient with my answers. So
your answers were really good. We liked them.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thanks a lot. Take care and bye bye.
You're welcome.
Bye everyone. Bye.
Fab Four Free For All was edited and produced by Tony Triguardo at Word of Mouth Studios in Westbury, New York.
The opening and closing theme is My Dolly by the band The Badge, featuring longtime listener Jeff Slate, available on its debut album Digital Retro and recent Best Of compilation, as well as from the Fab 4 Free For All website.
Thanks for listening to Fab 4 Free For All.